Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Intratex Gas Company versus Richard Beeson and others from Harris County. Eric Wilson and Attorney General John Cornyn versus Mary Andrews in her official capacity as Civil Service Director of the City of Lubbock and others from Lubbock County. And in the matter of the marriage of Donald Paul Jones and Rosemary Jaworski Jones, and in the interest of minor children and Dr. Lawrence Abrams versus Donald Paul Jones from Harris County. In each of these three causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete these arguments before the noon break. Justice O'Neill is not participating in the first case. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Intratex versus Beeson.
May it please the court. This is a suit for non-ratable taking by Intratex among 2,000 plus wells along the Oasis pipeline. After a year, the plaintiffs in the case moved to certify it as a class action. The trial court, after an evidentiary hearing, certified one class and one issue, which the Court of Appeals affirmed with one justice dissenting. We have given the court a bench booklet that has the class certified and the class issue. The class was defined as all persons who were producers of natural gas to the defendant between January 1, 78 and December 31, 88, whose natural gas was taken in quantities less than their rateable proportions. And the matching issue certified by the court was whether Intratex took ratably from the class as alleged in this cause. It's interesting that the trial court did specifically refuse to certify any other causes of action or any other issues. This case, I think, gives the court the opportunity to make four extremely important holdings in the area of class actions. The first is whether or not a so-called fail-safe class defined in terms of the ultimate outcome is proper. The second is whether or not, if there are truly predominant issues, whether the common issues, whether the answers to those issues must be such as the Brister case has held, that the answer to one class representative is an answer to all. A third important holding would be one which meets an issue in the Court of Appeals opinion, and that is whether or not a harmless error rule can be used to essentially trump admitted errors in class actions for the simple reason that a trial court who has committed error may cure that error on remand. And the fourth would be whether or not this court should adopt the federal principle which was recently discussed in potential amendment to Federal Rule 23, whether probable relief justifies the costs and burdens, more particularly whether or not a class should be certified if it appears on the face of the record that there is very little likelihood that relief can be obtained. Of the many interesting issues in this case, I will argue two this morning. Is the class definition proper because it is couched in terms of an ultimate liability issue? Number two, if there are common questions, do they predominate in this case?
If we were to answer in your favor on the first question, the answer would be the answer to the second question is the question of predominance.
Your Honor, someone coughed when you started the question, and I'm so sorry.
If we were to answer the first question in your favor, whether this is a fail-safe class, would we answer the second question, that is, whether common issues predominate?
Your Honor, a very good question. That is wrapped up, I suppose, in what this court's power would be upon finding error. If the court were to say, insofar as the class definition is concerned, we remand for simply reconsideration of the class definition, I would say that you are virtually commanded to reach the second issue because
why
we would
that?
Obtain because we would obtain greater relief. The answer to the second question would seem to me almost to be able to say this class cannot be certified, at least on this record.
But isn't it important to know what the class is, how it is defined, in order
Absolutely.
To consider the second issue, and that is whether the issues as to that class...
And Your Honor's point is well taken. If the definition fails, then it is, as you correctly say, almost impossible to link the members of the class to either a discrete issue of law or a common scheme.
So we have to stop after the first issue then.
Well, I personally, as I say, again, it depends upon your interpretation of the harmless error rule. My interpretation of the harmless error rule is this, that if you find error in the class, it is your obligation to simply reverse the certification and remand, not with instructions. The reason being that the harmless error rule says that this court, upon finding error, in a trial court order or judgment, must render that judgment which the trial court should have rendered. But if you find that the trial court abused its discretion in certifying a class, there is no judgment that the trial court should have rendered. If that's the interpretation of the harmless error rule that the court indulges, which I think is correct, you are correct that the answer to the first question should give us the maximum relief to which we are entitled.
Can an appellate court redefine a class before remanding?
Your Honor, there is very little writing on that point. My belief is, for the reasons that I just stated, the enjoinder of the harmless error rule in Texas prevents you from doing that. It seems to me that what would happen in that case is that you would be substituting your discretion for that of the trial court. Justice Link in this case has, in my judgment, demonstrated some considerable reluctance to certify an extremely broad class or any other class other than the one that he did. He specifically rejected certifying a class as to causes of action. So I think that it would be very presumptuous of this court to try to redefine the class and make Judge Link try a case that he has indicated he does not necessarily wish to try. Thank you very much, Your Honor. The court, of course, is very familiar with the principles regarding the importance of the definition. The definition determines who gets notice of the class and who gets notice to opt in or opt out. It determines what questions are common. It determines the nature of the relief that can be given. And most importantly, it determines who is bound. The particular principles of law that must be applied to the definition are that the definition must be precise. And to be precise, it must be defined by objective criteria. And those objective criteria must lead to a class that is presently, today, ascertainable. There are obvious problems with our definition, which is couched in terms of the ultimate decision on rateability, which includes, as I understand it, a number of disparate theories to reach that point. Number one, it is not precise because it is couched in terms of the resolution of liability, which is not an objective fact, but a blend of law and fact. Number two, the class is not presently ascertainable. Today, we do not know who's in the class. That must await the trial on the merits. And third, the class is not objectively defined. It has been defined in this case only by the opinion of an expert as to the merits based upon a legal standard which is not recognized either by the Railroad Commission or Texas common law, and whose study the Court of Appeals itself conceded would be an issue at trial. So the legal consequences of such a definition are really quite dire in terms of the very reasons we have class actions. We must await a trial on the merits to determine who is in the class because it is subject to a methodology that may change, it may be declared admissible, or it may be rejected by the ultimate trier of fact. It also, and this is I think most important, creates a fail-safe class that ultimately doesn't bind anyone. The difficulty that defendants face on this kind of fail-safe class definition is that if they prevail, the ultimate result is not a judgment that binds all the class members. The ultimate result is to say there was never any class to begin with, and therefore the plaintiffs essentially get to try to retool their lawsuit and try again. And in this particular case where you have three class representatives who are all subject to different criteria in terms of their particular well situation, there are insurmountable problems that are posed if the resolution of this class definition is different as to each one. Then, who is in the class and who is not?
For what purpose during the class certification proceeding did the class representatives offer Mr. Rhodes' testimony?
For what purpose?
Yes.
Did they offer?
They offered for to show numerosity. Did
clearly,
they offer
clearly
to
for
define
numerosity.
The class? What was the purpose of his testimony, and how was it presented to the trial court?
I believe that they offered it. Your Honor, I can see reading the record that they were backed into somewhat of a corner in this case, because they used it first of all to define a group of wells which, according to the particular subjective methodology that was employed, that were supposedly undertaken. That then was theoretically to define the common issue, either a common issue of fact or a common issue of law. But I think also, because of the fact that the study led to the fact that 50% of the people in that particular study were either ratably taken or were overtaken, they were then backed into the corner of saying, well, we can't define the class on anything other than the ultimate liability. So for two purposes, or actually for three purposes, numerosity, commonality, and the class definition.
Then how did the evidence about the Dow waiver agreement fit into the preceding class certification?
Well, the Dow waiver agreement is talked about in the pleadings. It was talked about in the arguments. But it was not a part of Mr. Rhodes' study, other than to the extent that he recognized it existed. But I think it's extremely important to notice that in Mr. Rhodes' study, upon which this class must rest, he assumed that the Dow waiver program was not operative. In other words, he assumed that all of the takes were attributable to intratex.
In their brief, respondents talk about the Dow waiver agreement as possibly providing the basis for defining the class. Is it futile to attempt to define a class in this case, or can the Dow waiver agreement provide the basis for the trial court to define a class?
Your Honor, there are, I think, three answers to that question. Number one, that was not the class certified. So you immediately bring yourself back to the proposition that you and I just talked about, and that is, can this court basically reform down a class and force the trial court to try a class that was not certified? Number two, it's also important to notice that the Dow waiver program did not cover the entire time period that has been certified in this case. It only covers a limited portion. So if you redefine the class down to simply those wells which were excluded from the Dow waiver program, then you're also going to have to carve upon the time period as well. Number three.
Doesn't that inure to the benefit of
the time period? It does, at least in that limited extent, but to further answer Justice Hankinson's question with the third point, which is very important, as you raised, going to the Rhodes study brings you simply to a smaller microcosm of the points that we believe make individual issues predominate in this case, which are as follows. As the court knows, the class must be united by common principles of law. The answer to one must be the answer to all, and it must advance the litigation. We know in this case that if you simply take those wells which were excluded from the Dow waiver program and look at them alone, 50% of them were either taken ratably or overtaken. So then where does that lead you? I believe that RSR versus Hayes, Texas case.
Well, are you arguing then that when you take the smallest class that's possible under the way you're going, that you end up with no class?
No, that's
nobody,
not what I argue.
Nobody fits.
Are you in this case? Actually, if you take the Dow waiver class, it's a larger class. The class that they have attempted to define is 900, roughly, or slightly under 900. A Dow waiver class would be approximately 1,800, of which more than 50% we know would be either ratably taken or overtaken.
Meaning they don't qualify for damages.
No, they don't qualify for damages, but that brings up the policy question of then, as raised in RSR versus Hayes. When you know going in that more than 50% of your class obviously are not linked to any theory of liability, either by a discrete issue of law or by some common theory of conduct, should it be the policy of the courts to certify a class in that instance, or should you look to some other class to certify? When they look to another class to certify in this case, all they could find was a class that says, well, it's those people who are ultimately going to win. If you're talking about balancing having to do a fail-safe class versus the other type of class, Your Honor, I say that you always opt not to do a fail-safe class.
Separate from the other requirements of the class certification rule, our efforts, if we agree with you that this is a fail-safe class, are any further efforts to certify in this, a class in this case futile, or can a class be defined?
Your Honor, I think a class can be defined, but I think it leads ultimately to futility. And the reason for that has to do with the nature of a rateable takes claim itself. A rateable takes claim is dependent upon four extremely important components.
Well, I'm interested at this point, before you move on to the other
sure.
requirements, just whether or not, before we end the requirements, whether or not a class could be defined that does not run into the problems that you claim this class definition
carries. No, I do not believe so. No, I do not believe there can be such a class.
Why not?
Because every time you attempt to define, a class, first of all, there has been no exposition of a theory by which a significant class can be linked either by a common theory of law or by a common nucleus of facts. And I think any group of these well owners that you identify is going to have that same problem. It's ultimately going to lead to an individual, well by well, month by month examination of the factors which are important to a rateability claim.
But Mr. Hatchell, if you have a non-rateable take test, don't you have to show all this information talked about as well by well, month by month, producer by producer? I come in and I have a claim as an individual, as a producer, I want to pursue that claim on my own. Aren't I going to have to show all of that anyway to show that my well was not rateably taken? Isn't that going to be part of a non-rateable case, whether or not it's a class action or not?
Yes, absolutely. But the mix and combination of factors that underlie a rateability claim are going to be different as to each well, and then that's going to be extrapolated to differences as to each person.
But then that ultimately goes to damages.
No, it does not.
And the need to determine damages individually in a case does not preclude a proper class action.
No, Your Honor, that is not correct. Many of the factors which are relevant to a rateability claim, such as what system is it on, what field is it in, what is the allowable, go to a determination of the way in which the available volumes are spread first to the field and then to the individual wells. There is expert testimony in this case that if a well drops out of that mix, in other words, if you have problems with, let's say, force majeure behind a plant that is down, a well that is blown out, that well comes out of the mix and those volumes are then spread over the rest of the systems and fields, and as a result of that, the issue then is not one of damages, but what is the rateable proportion. In addition to that, I think the court should understand that there are two components to this class definition. Number one, what is the rateable proportion, but also did we take? And the did we take portion of the class definition requires then for you to look at the particular specific circumstances of each take. Thank
what
you.
Do you consider to be the most judicially and economically efficient way of handling this case?
Hold that this is a fail-safe class. Say that as a result, hold that this is a fail-safe class. Because the definition is very much like the foundation of a building, the whole class the class falls, you reverse and remand without instructions. The trial court can then pursue whatever discretion he wishes on the cause as remanded.
And what I'm saying, that when you get back to the trial court, presuming that you prevail here the way that you were suggesting, what would be the most economically and judicially efficient way of proceeding with resolving this case?
That's a very good question, and I'm not altogether certain. I think that if you could identify common themes or a common theory, common legal theory, or a common nucleus of facts, our rules, particularly Rule 166A and our joinder rules, give the trial court ample opportunity or ample ability to group particular plaintiffs and try those accordingly. But that's the only efficient way that I see, other than a
subclass.
Well, Your Honor, subclasses have not been defined in this case, and subclasses lead...
No, but the answer was, if it goes back and fail, no instruction, and comment the subclass.
Yes, there are, except bear in mind that you can have going to have a minimum of subclasses, of 37 subclasses in this case, because a system is a discrete unit for judging rateability. One wonders whether or not, and then within each one of those subclasses, you again have a reduced microcosm of the very problems that you have in this case, because rateability is not only within the system as to well, it's also within the system between field and field, so you get into the same individual well-by-well, month-by-month, producer-by-producer. One wonders whether or not that's a superior method, and one wonders whether or not that kind of class is manageable at all.
Well, your comment suggests that there's a possibility of having 37 trials in part.
Yes.
As opposed to 8 trials. Okay.
There is a
period of time.
Well, it can be looked at. I have grave doubts by reason of the nature of a rateable takes claim that can really be done. But that is about the only way it's going to be able to be done.
Well, you suggest in your briefing that the Railroad Commission could and should resolve rateable take claims.
Your Honor, I think our briefing suggests that there is no private cause of action under 111.086.
Do you concede that they have a federal case to the contrary?
No. We have a federal case supports our position. The Sowell case states that there is no private cause of action under 111.086.
But assuming that you do, I thought you said in your briefing that the remedy lies at the Railroad Commission, that if the Railroad Commission determines there were non-rateable takes, then the Railroad Commission can fashion the appropriate remedy.
Yes.
And how would wouldn't the Railroad Commission face the same problems as the trial court?
No, Your Honor, the Railroad Commission has much more leeway and flexibility. It does not have to apply any particular legal standards. It has developed its own set of criteria, which it is not necessarily bound to follow. But it goes upon an equitable approach and a fairness doctrine, and it also has many more tools available to it than are available at law, such as the requirements for over and under productions, carry forwards, and
they would still have
to
determine whether there had been historically non-rateable takes. They would still have to go into the analyses that you're talking about, well by well.
Absolutely, they do, Your Honor, but I think that I do want to make clear that I do think that the absence of any private cause of action under 111.086 is what brings this court at least to an opportunity to consider whether or not you actually should look at the merits, whether or not Texas should adopt a rule that says you look at the merits in deciding, at least on a limited basis, to the point that if it appears on the face of the pleadings that no relief can be granted, or that the possibility of relief so far outweighs the costs and burdens of class, that is one of the discretionary factors that the court should look at. And we think the court is going to hold, when it looks at this, that there is no private cause of action, at least insofar as the cause of action that has been certified here.
How would you advise a reviewing appellate court to determine that while there might be an appropriate class that could be defined, and it might meet all the various requirements of Rule 42, that the possibility of relief is, in your words, so remote that it does not outweigh the benefits? How come that's not inherently a trial court determination, whose discretion must be
used. Your Honor, personally, I believe that it is, and it has been so held at the federal level, but the difficulty we have in Texas is this litany of cases, case after case after case, that says that you can't look at the merits. I don't think that's true. I think Your Honor's suggestion is absolutely true, but I think that this court needs to speak and illuminate that for the trial court, because the message is simply not getting through. In cases where, on the face of the pleadings, there is no stated cause of action, we are required to go through the rigors of class certification and sending notices before we can ever get to that point.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, let me first answer Justice Hankinson's question relating to the Dow waiver takings. The record's absolutely clear in this case that two separate grounds for certification were urged on the trial court, the Dow waiver takings and the Rhodes study, and they're mutually exclusive. They're different takings. And let me explain this because I think it goes a long way towards explaining why common issues also predominate this case, especially as to the Rhodes study. Your Honor, the Dow waiver takings. In the Dow waiver takings, we had a situation where Intertex had already set the amount of gas it was going to nominate or take throughout the Oasis pipeline. And thereafter, gas was waived by another producer to Intertex. And as a result, they went back and made purchases from discrete wells and fields along this system to the exclusion of any other wells or fields. So it wasn't a situation where you have to spread things over the field, determine allowables, determine nominations, and those types of things. There was no gas taken with those takings. On its face, it was, if it were a sale and if it were a purchase of gas, it was a non-rateable taking because some was taken from some well and none was taken from another. Now, the judge was in this unique position. On Dow waiver, it was a gut sense for certification of the class. And the class could be, better defined perhaps, as all the producers along the pipeline during this time period whose gas was not taken pursuant to Dow waiver.
How can we tell, though, from the definition which class was certified? We have to dig back into the record and make certain assumptions, don't we?
Yes, Your Honor, to some extent, but I think the court is aided in that. There's no doubt that this was urged on the court as a basis for certification, and I want to emphasize it was the first thing urged in the arguments of counsel as the first reason to certify, and at the end, when the other side had talked only about road study and did not mention Dow waiver, at the end we said that's the basis, again, for certifying the class.
So when we go back to send out the notices, and you say all those who were not taken from rateably,
yes.
How do you know, just looking at the class definition, whether what time periods are covered, whether it's based on the Dow waiver, or whether it's based on the road study, how can you tell based on the class definition itself?
I think it is fairly certain that you're going to be able to tell that exactly. Here's why, Your Honor. This is not like the cases that have been cited by the petitioner of the Houston case of everybody who was interested in the peace or active in the peace movement in Houston in the 60s, or like the case from the Midwest, the federal court case from the Seventh Circuit, of everybody whose child was not timely diagnosed. We know exactly who these people are. We not only know their identity, we know their address.
But those who did not sign a Dow waiver agreement, and you contend that they were not taken from rateably. But Mr. Rhodes has also said there were others, in addition to those, who were not taken from rateably. So how do we know, based on the class definition, who's in the class?
Your Honor, I think we can do it several ways. First off, again, we know that I think the Fifth Circuit has looked at an issue exactly like this in the Mullen case, which we have passed out to you this morning, and they've addressed this issue. And by the way, Mullen is not in either side's briefing. Mullen is Mullen versus Treasure City that was decided 4 days after our last brief was due. And by the way, let me tell you, as of 3 weeks ago, rehearing was denied and rehearing in Bonk was denied in that case. In Mullen, the same argument regarding the definition that is made by the petitioners was made there. They said, one, it's a fail-safe class. Two, you can't tell. What had happened in Mullen was it was a class action by employees of the floating casino in New Orleans that were claiming that their lungs had been damaged by secondhand smoke. And this was decided after Castano. And the Fifth Circuit, a different panel, taking a look at that, one of the first issues they address is the definition, which was all employees crew of the vessel who claim to have injuries and additionally that were caused by the defective air conditioning system or ventilation system. Obviously defining it with the merits of the case. What they said, what the Fifth Circuit says is, listen, that's not a problem. It's not a problem and hadn't been a problem in this circuit since Forbush was decided, which was a Judge Higginbotham case. And Judge Higginbotham said the issue of a fail-safe class and the idea that you don't know who these people are is meritless. That you can define, and in footnote one of the opinion says that you can define based upon the definition, or excuse me, the certified question, number one, and number two is as long as the people are ascertainable. Now, when you compare Mullen on the one hand with the definition of people whose injuries were caused by the ventilation system versus the notice system here where we know precisely the name and address of each of these people in the Road Study 970 wells and in the Dow Waiver wells, it is obvious that the definition here gives much more adequate notice than the definition in Mullen would give.
Hey, Mr. Kellman, let me ask you. It appears that Mr. Hatchell in the brief defines a fail-safe class as one where if judgment is rendered in favor of the plaintiffs, it's binding on the defendant. If judgment is rendered for the plaintiffs in this case, that is that their gas was not ratably taken, then it's a judgment that's binding on the defendant that failed to take it ratably. But if the judgment is that the gas was ratably taken, it simultaneously destroys the class and therefore results in no binding judgment against the plaintiffs. Do you agree that that is an accurate definition of a fail-safe class? I mean, that's how you define a fail-safe class.
Yes, that is how a fail-safe class is defined.
Okay, in the briefing, presented with the Mullen case, but in your briefing, it was not clear to me that unless you use the Dow waiver, you really do have a fail-safe class, because the only other way to identify the plaintiffs, absent the Dow waiver, is a plaintiff whose gas was not taken ratably.
Your Honor, I must concede that point. You're absolutely right. As to the Dow waiver takings, this is not a fail-safe class.
Well, but doesn't the class definition, isn't it broader as it's stated now than just the Dow waiver takings?
Yes, but it would certainly include the Dow waiver takings. And I think that
But what about those outside? Right. Doesn't it put them then in a position of us having to have a determination on the merits from the trial court on the ratable take claim in order to determine ultimately who's in the class and whether or not they're bound?
Your Honor, I have to concede that point. That is true.
Well, if that's the case and we have an overly broad class definition, what is the appropriate course for this court to take? Can we redefine the class, or must we remand to the trial court for further consideration?
I think two things are true. First off, let me tell you that I think you first can reform the class. Texas courts have done that. In fact, if you recall, in the Ford Paint case that you heard several months ago, Judge Abusi did redefine the class to get over precisely the problem, the fail-safe problem that was done here.
That.
Sir?
I said, we're still thinking about what Judge Abusi did.
Yes, sir. That's true, but the points in the brief were on other grounds, Your Honor, not that one, which I think is a crucial point.
Well, what
point
about their comment that, well, if appellate courts can look at these cases and say, well, we don't like that one, but we might like this one, that that's that court using its discretion based on a record as opposed to determining whether the trial court did or didn't abuse own discretion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree that this is an abuse of discretion review?
I think we have to look at the entire body of our jurisprudence on abuse of discretion to make that determination, not just the one that the petitioners would require. For example, in this case, there were no requests for findings of fact and conclusions of law to test on what grounds.
Well, with all due respect, you don't have them in abuse of discretion standard.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
They're not determinative of an outcome vis-a-vis discretion standard.
Your Honor, I think that's true, and I'd even go a step further. They're not, the trial court would not be required to file them, but that is, they weren't requested in this point as an opportunity to find it out. Candidly, as we have indicated in the briefs, we would live with the Dow waiver class. The Dow waiver class, as Mr. Hatchell told you, is the far larger class here.
Well, but then you've already conceded that the Devine class is broader than the Dow waiver.
Yes, sir. I must tell you it is.
Then that requires us or somebody else to redefine it to be what you say you now think is a good class that will survive.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can we do
that? Excuse me?
Can we do that?
Yes, sir.
Should we do that?
Well, you can certainly do it, or you can remand it to the trial court with instructions to do that. And that's generally what happens in these types of cases. They are sent back if there's a definitional problem for those kinds of situations. Some courts, like the Austin Court of Appeals and Judge Boosie, went ahead and redefined the class herself to take care of the fail-safe issue.
What authority is there in the federal jurisprudence for an appellate court to redefine a class?
Your Honor, I agree with Mr. Hatchell. There's not much. Not much at all.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Hatchell. If we do decide that the class definition is not proper in this case, should we or can we discuss or decide any of the other issues going to the other requirements for class certification?
I disagree with Mr. Hatchell, not unpredictably, that you can. And the reason for that is, and especially I think your question was centered on, the issue of commonality and predominance.
Yes.
In this case, I think that there is no doubt that you can. There is certainly a definable case based on the Dow waiver issue. And I want to remember that since we're dealing with abuse of discretion, you need to look what the trial court was faced with here, because it's an unusual situation. He had a gut cinch, I think, on Dow waiver class. Not very many actually common issues at all. And in fact, once the liability, and let me tell you this, the issue on damages, and let me address that up front on commonality, and then I'll get back to what the trial court was dealing with. In the arguments to the court and into the presentations, one thing was absolutely clear. You asked the question, Judge Hankinson, of why was road study introduced. It was introduced to demonstrate that it was possible to make ratable taking determinations by number crunching of historic look-back data, objective data. And in fact, even their expert, who was offered to counter Rhodes, admitted it was possible to do, one, a study that would demonstrate whether ratable takings were taken, but second, to also demonstrate what those damages were. In any eventual trial of this case, it is clear the common questions will predominate, because the real issue is going to be, as we get to the trial, it's going to be a number crunch based upon, and both experts, the uncontroverted testimony is, that can be done here.
Let me ask on commonality, do you agree with Mr. Hatchell that rateability will turn on 37 discrete systems?
No.
Intertech?
Absolutely not. Your Honor, here's why I don't think it's going to turn that way. As defendants in every class action case, they've tried to interject theories of liability and defense that will create individualized questions. Some of those questions that will determine how the numbers are crunched on damages and liability are going to be legal questions that are common to everybody that will be submitted to the court. For example, one of the theories that they have for you is that you are entitled to net undertakes with subsequent overtakes. For example, if there was an undertake in 1978 of a well that was a non-rateable taking, their claim is that you get to go back maybe in 1988 and net that take against an overtake. Now, that the overtake would also, as you know, be a non-rateable taking.
My specific question is, what's your position on the legal issue of the 37 systems?
The one systems? Yes. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misunderstood your question. I think it is clear that it is one system. This is Rule 3.34 of the Railroad Commission that was passed in 1987. At the very end of this time period, at a time that the Dow waiver takes were already finished. So it, one, doesn't affect Dow waiver. But second, with that regulation that the Railroad Commission adopted, the Railroad Commission told everybody that said, listen, we're going to, if you have one physical system that is hooked up together, you can't subsequently go back and redesignate it as discrete parts in an effort to get around the non-ratable taking laws. So I think on the merits of that case, and I'm not sure it's appropriate to visit the merits of that here, but on the merits of that issue, I think we win, and it'll be the same answer for everybody along the pipeline and everybody in the class. Again, there are going to be some other, Justice Owen, determinations that are the same. The netting determinations. The judge is going to tell us legally in a common question of law how that is done. And then the number crunchers will be able to do it. This is going to be done in one trial. There will be witnesses sponsoring these reports, but that's what it's going to, that's how it's going to rate. Getting Justice Hankson back to your question, here's what the trial judge had, and it was an upsetting thing for him, and if you read the record, you can tell why. He had Dow waiver. He thought it was a gut cinch reason to certify a class. And then he had the road study, which indicated, based on Rhodes' determination, that there were 970 wells in other takings that might also have claims. Now, Rhodes did make some assumptions, as the petitioner says. In the main, those assumptions were because discovery had not been completed. And in fact, at the trial, there was an admission that the discovery, one, had not been completed and accurate records weren't there. And the petitioner at trial even admitted that complete discovery of that would change the members of the road study class. So the judge is thinking, okay, I have one I can certify with no problem. The other, I've got to look at and make a determination, and I don't have everything. And here's what he did, and it's tab 12 to our briefing. He writes a letter and says, I'm going to go ahead and certify. This is before he comes up with a definition. I'm going to go ahead and certify, but the one thing I'm not going to do is let individual issues drive this case. And if I determine that subsequently they do, I'm going to decertify. And then he sends out, some weeks later, his determination order.
What is the process? How should a judge apply?
The federal circuits are virtually identical on this issue, although they sometimes, Judge Gonzalez, describe these issues slightly differently. They say that on predominance, the common issues have to have significance in the trial. Let me take Mullen, for example. I know in this court you've heard Ford Paint, you've heard Bernal, and the issue of predominance on those cases where you had radically individualized theories of damages, where here it's the same type of damage. It's not pain and suffering, it's not mental anguish, it's not something that's personal to an individualized defendant. We're there. We don't have that here, but the standard is that it has to be significant in resolving the case. In this case, and in fact, let me tell you, in Mullen they say, if liability is resolved, they reach the conclusion that that is significant enough to result in predominance. I must admit to you, that's somewhat out of the different than what the Fifth Circuit in a sister panel said in Castano. I don't think it's the same, but I think it is when you compare what the other individual issues are in this case. And remember, in Castano and the other cases that this case, this court was interested in both Ford Payne and Bernal, the big issues were, well, proximate cause is different to everybody. Not true here. No proximate cause determination. Second, damages will be personal to each of these people. The act will affect the plaintiffs in different ways. They'll have mental anguish damages. They'll have pain and suffering, loss of wage earning capacity that are obviously individual determinations. Not true here. They took our gas non-ratably. The contract price
determines. Won't there have to be determinations if you're going to do a well-by-well damage analysis? Won't you have to determine what was available, what was requested, what the reasons were why the gas wasn't available well by well, all of those individualized issues for each well?
Your Honor, in some instances, some of that will have to be done, not all. Remember, the evidence in this case is that the Bolden Memorandum, and you as an oil and gas lawyer will know about that. That is, Mr. Bolden was the head of proration for the Railroad Commission for years, and he came up with a methodology to use in doing this kind of analysis. By the way, that's Plaintiff's Exhibit 6 in the record. Bolden doesn't go into all these individual issues. Now, they do go into some, but not nearly the ones that the petitioner claims. But in this case, even if you go into them, this is a matter of an objective historical look back. Intratex has admitted all of that information is on magnetic tape in their records.
Well, you say that. I'm curious. Do they have the the requests were on magnetic tape? Do they have whether the pumper actually went out there and turned on the well in response to the request? I mean, those kinds of individual issues that would determine whether a particular well, whose fault it was, for example, that it was not taken right away.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there was in I don't know precisely what is on each of those magnetic tapes. I have seen the results of some of those produced in discovery, and a significant amount of that information was on. So much so that in the depositions of the class representatives, they questioned on those matters. So I think that information, in fact, is there. And the judge was very concerned about it not being accurate and up to date in what had been produced. And that was, again, one of the issues in this case.
One other question.
Should
we look at the ultimate merits? Should we look at whether you have a rateability cause of action under the Common Purchaser Act at all?
Your Honor, if you make that determination, and I disagree with the petitioners on this, you will be the first court in this union to do so, and certainly the first Supreme Court, or court of last resort to do it. The Supreme Court looked at this issue in Eisen, albeit under different circumstances, I'll admit, and made the decision that you should not do it because it would be a determination on the merits.
But what if it were just patently it didn't exist? I know they quoted the judge in Eisen and said you shouldn't even dismiss it on the pleadings, but what if it were an NIED claim or something that the law was perfectly clear did not exist?
Your Honor, you create the best case possible, and it's difficult to argue with some of that logic, except to say this. Think about the principles we're trying to set here, in fairness to both sides.
Clear. Unless it were subject to change, I mean, in a securities fraud case, it wasn't perfectly clear. In NIED, it's closer to being clear.
Yes, sir. And I understand your point. I would say this. I think one thing the trial courts do look at in their discretion is basically that kind of issue. And I'm not going to try to tell you that doesn't happen routinely in cases. And I think that's why our system doesn't get to be this way. Now,
but you've got a breach of contract claim in this case, don't you?
Yes, we do, for incorporating the same rateable takings. We disagree on whether the judge certified on that, let me first tell you. We believe that he certainly did, but we have that. Additionally, I would tell you, the other thing in this issue is we strongly believe there is a private cause of action under this court's decision, ACCI, as well. And by the way, they mentioned, someone asked about, Justice Enoch, I believe you asked about the federal court case. That was Sowell. That case is decided against us on other grounds. However, the HCI case by this court was not decided by that time, and it was decided on a ground different than the ones argued here.
Mr. Kellner, I have one more question. Judge Link in this case did indicate if I determine along the way that the individual issue taking over this case, I can be certified. How far must a trial court go at the certification stage to plan how it is going to handle individual issues?
Your Honor, pretty good way, and we don't contend otherwise. I think a court at certification has a look forward. Look forward about what the predominant issues will be and what the common issues are. And I think that look forward is got to be, to some degree, a prediction of what will happen. And then, candidly, if the court is ambushed by the plaintiff and it turns out that these are individualized issues, I think that there is certainly a remedy. And I think that's it. Now, this court, looking at Bloyed, for example, where the plaintiffs say that there is a no-doubt rule put in force, I don't think the court meant to do that in Bloyed. And this court has sometimes changed the law, but it's always been very honest when it's done it and said, look out, here it is. We are changing the law. We think the better rationale is that. In Bloyad, I don't think you did it. And remember, in Bloyad, we had a look back. In Bloyad, the trial court was looking back, and to accept the settlement had to say that the class action had to have been maintainable as a class action as a condition to the settlement.
Why shouldn't the class be all producers on the Oasis system?
Your Honor, that was the first definition we asked the trial court for. And there is, I believe that that would be a separate certifiable class. I'm not sure that it would, in the notice letter, would have to tell those people what the claims the class were making, though. But it could very well be that, and we started the class certification with making that suggestion to the judge.
But abandoned for reasons that the trial court indicated he wasn't going to certify it?
No, sir. And let me tell you from the record, that is unclear. It was suggested at one point. Then we were suggested to come up with other definitions. A series of four were submitted over the three-day hearing.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hatchell, would the Dow waiver class be proper to the final class?
Your Honor, probably not. For this reason, the Dow waiver class unquestionably eliminates the problem of defining the class in terms of the ultimate outcome. But what a Dow waiver class does not do is to link all of the putative class members together with some common theory of law or some common nucleus of facts. And let me
talk about the common theory of law. If the only issue in Dow waiver is whether or not it's a fail, wouldn't that be equally binding on the defendant as well as the class members of the claim?
Indeed it would, Your Honor, except that it is not the only issue. In a predominance inquiry, I like it from my old management school days at the University of Texas. It's kind of like a time and motion study. The issue of sales has been admitted by the plaintiffs in this case to be a summary judgment issue. How long is that going to take? A couple of hours of argument, 3 or 4 hours of study by the judge, and then under the Brister standard, where is the laboring effort in this class going to be? If you assume that the Dow waiver program must attribute purchases to Intertex, then you are simply back into the same microcosm that causes there to be no predominance of common issues in this case, because bear in mind, it's extremely important to notice that Mr. Rhodes' study assumed that the takes in this case were takes by Intertex. He assumed that the Dow waiver program was not proper, and I think counsel is just simply mistaken when he says that the takes are exclusive. They're not, not at least under the Rhodes study. So if you have a situation where, as Mr. Rhodes finally had to concede, that I have done a study assuming Dow waiver was really a take by Intertex, and I have determined that 50% of the wells that were non-Dow waiver wells were ratably taken or were overtaken, should the policy be to certify a class of that nature? And we take the position no, because you know going in that there is something inherent in that class that either makes people ratably taken or overtaken. So is there either a common thread of law or a common nucleus of facts that justifies the class? And no.
For those persons whose wells were undertaken, is it possible they have an individual cause of action? Do you concede that?
Oh, yes.
If they do, why isn't a class type of remedy superior here, even if 50% are going to be excluded? That why are you putting 900 people why are you putting the judicial system to 900 individual trials?
If you consider a rateable takes claim a coalescence of a number of components, There is no single resolution of a rateable takes claim as to each of the 900. You have to look at the combination of factors that affect each well, which is then extrapolated to purchasers. The problem with the road study is that it is nothing. I mean, first of all, it disregards entirely the essential basis for a rateable takes claim, which Justice Owen was speaking about a moment ago, and the reason I say there have to be 37 subclasses, he pretends that there are not 37 systems. A rateable takes claim must be done
just to the Dow waiver.
But it must be done within a system. Rateable takes must be done within a system. So even if we should lose the Dow waiver issues, you then have to drop back to look at how this operates within each system, then within each field, and then as to each well. Dow waiver, in other words, assume we lose the Dow waiver. Do you then say that Intertex steps aside and all of the producers just begin to send in a bill?
Why couldn't a comprehensive rateable take study be done? That would answer the question as to everybody.
Your Honor, there is a memorandum in this case by the Railroad Commission that says if you look at rateable takes on a system-wide basis as wide as Mr. Rhodes has done, a rateable take study is impossible. And I think that is probably...
But isn't that a legal issue to be decided up front?
No, I don't think so, because again, I think you drop back because of the combination of factors to a well-by-well, month-by-month study to determine not only what was the rateable portion, which could be affected by any one of a number of categories, but then did we take? Let me give you just one example. The well that constitutes 10% of the damages in this case, $39 million, is extrapolated by Mr. Rhodes under his study that assumed that the Dow waiver program was not proper and that these were our takes, was a well that was blown in for most of the time period. Now, that's not a question of a defense by us. This was a well that could not produce even if we asked for it. And those factors multiply in terms of when wells are behind a common meter point. Why did we not get what we asked for? Was a gas plant, for example, out of
business?
But
wouldn't that affect the rateability as to other producers even in the same system? Wouldn't you have to determine all of those factors to determine rateable share on a field-by-field and then well-by-well basis?
Yes, you do. You have to determine all of those factors as to each well each month. There is no common thread that links a theory of liability in this case that can disregard all of those factors.
Once you determine liability as to a particular well, is there any other issue as to damages?
Yes, there is, Your Honor, because a number of these wells the owners of these wells would have interests in other wells. And under the road study, we've demonstrated that we may have overtaken as to those. So then you have the other issue of balancing out to determine whether or not
is there any other issue? Besides the netting argument, is there any other issue?
Well, of course, limitations. It's always an issue. That's a big issue in this case, and we're going to win.
The reason why there shouldn't be a class of all producers on the system, on the Oasis pipeline, there's no common issues between all of those folks?
Not identified as of yet, Your Honor, and that brings us, I think, to the final policy issue facing this court. Counsel says, well, I admit that that's true. Rhodes was just kind of sort of speculating about what might happen. And so here we are, assuming that, for example, that we have lost the Dow waiver issue. Then they say, but we don't have enough discovery at this point to determine who is in this class or whether or not there's common issues and whether or not they predominate. That then brings the court, I think, to the issue. In the federal cases, you will find some federal cases that say, oh, yes, you always certify, and then you sort it out later. We believe that the policy in Texas should be, as counsel has admitted, if you do not have enough information, you do not go through the rigors of class certification by sending out notices and bringing that entire process, which diminishes the rights of individual litigation, until you're absolutely certain. So we think that their argument actually leads nowhere. They are asking you to reform the class, which we believe you cannot do. But in reforming the class, you simply drop down to the individualized issues which predominate this case and will always predominate this case until someone can give you a legal theory and a common nucleus of facts that links enough people to justify a class.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and the first cause, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.